the ravioli, put it just straight on the bowl, and then pour that consomme on top of it. Oh my God, put some aromatics like fresh herbs or something like that. Oh dude, come on now. Come on now. For a new hunter and going out and actually having this game sit there in your kitchen and you go, okay, I got to understand this as well as a new recipe. That's too much. That's a lot to unpack all at once. Our ancestors are laughing at us going, that was my everyday. That was literally what I did every single day. And you're posting about it on Pinterest. When I look at the history of where our food has been, there are all these lines that keep coming up and it's connecting all those. And that's kind of the way that I pull it all together. This is Josh Franca with Gastronomy Live Events in beautiful San Antonio, Texas. And you are listening to The Wild Initiative.
Put down your latte and pull on your boots.
You and I and everybody listening to this owns 640 million acres.
I think he killed more deer drinking his coffee, smoking his cigarette in the pickup truck than I did spending all that time freezing my butt off.
Something that I would hope is that people realize that those are wild animals and they have savage natures.
I look forward to packing animals out. I look forward to that pain of success.
Doesn't matter where you were born. It doesn't matter where you live. I've said it before, and you know what? I'll say it again louder for the people in the back. Your present circumstance should not limit your passions.
This is Jay Scott of the Jay Scott Outdoors Podcast.
Hey, this is Ryan Callahan.
Hi, this is Jules McLean.
Hey, everybody. Jason Carter here with Epic Outdoors.
Hey, guys. This is Tim Burnett with Solo Hunter.
You're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Hey, all, welcome to another episode of The Wild Initiative, brought to you as part of the Waypoint Outdoor Collective.
Midway USA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com.
Boat Trader, America's largest boating marketplace, offering easy financing and over 100,000 boat listings to choose from. Sell, find, and finance new or used boats on America's largest boating marketplace. Visit BoatTrader.com to get started.
All right, y'all. So hopping into today's episode, I am on the line with Chef Joshua Schwenka. I'm grinning right now because we were joking about name pronunciations earlier, and it's hard for me not to laugh at the moment. But
well, it was hard for me to find a wife that would take that last name. My wife went from four letters to seven. So she
Excuse me. Can I please speak with Mrs.
Schwink. Oh man.
Schwinky.
Oh,
I'm sorry. No, there's no one here by that name. Thank you. Stop calling us at dinner.
So I have told you that story. Yeah, that's about right.
It's just our last name. Everyone mispronounces it as well. So that was how you'd always know when somebody was typically a cold caller or something they'd mispronounce the last name, but I digress. But I'm here with the one and only Chef Jay Schwenka of Gastronomy Live Events. Joshua, you're a culinary anthropologist. Is that the right?
Well, not an anthropologist, but what I do is I've studied anthropology. I've studied the food, the culinary side of our history. And kind of the connections that we have to our food and the connections that our food have to us, and looked at it under the lens of, obviously as a hunter, as a gatherer, as somebody who really does enjoy food. But truly, my background is the culinary portion of that. And I'm a history nut and I'm a science nut. So we just put all those together and we've kind of built our brand just around that sole premise of that there is something, there's a lure and there's something beautiful about food. And, how do we put events together with that at the core of what we do?
So I think, it's funny. We got a chance to meet at the, the FTW Ranch New Hunter Training Program that Tim Fallon put on.
Yeah, great guy. Amazing.
Oh, great guy. And it's, you know, it's funny how he kind of introduces you, though. You know, he's like, oh, and you guys all have a great time. You know, Josh is a great guy. And man, this guy will tell you more crap about what the Egyptians had for dessert every day than anyone ever wants to know.
This is his go-to. Every time he introduced me to the Navy SEALs team during that week. And they happened to be there. And that was the exact same thing. And he was like, Josh, kind of like, hey, do your dance for him. Let him know. Let him know exactly what it is. And I'm happy to do it. I love Tim, that entire staff. I mean, oh my God, that ranch is one of my favorite places on earth. Obviously. I mean, I'm wearing the hat. I'm wearing their merch. I gotta represent. So yeah, every time I see Tim and he's introducing me, I'm so proud of the relationship that we have with those guys. Cause they're passionate about what they do. It kind of mirrors the type of passion that you have, the type of passion that, you know, we have. And now good things are happening, man. They really are. Yeah, I love it.
But so I always like to start out with just to get going. What got you in? How did you get your introduction to like hunting, the outdoors, all of this stuff?
Oh my goodness. So, I used to spend a lot of my time on a farm outside of, if anybody knows Shiner Bock, it's a Bock beer. It's a Bavarian style Bock beer from here in Texas, not too far from San Antonio.
And anyone that has paid attention to my feed or knows me fairly well, that's been following along for a while, knows that's my hands down favorite beer. So
no, Shiner's amazing. So just outside of Shiner is a town of Yoakum. It's even smaller. But we have a family farm out there. A lot of Bavarians live out there, a lot of Czechs. So I spent my time out there and just understood the farming life, understood hunting. My dad was a hunter. My family came from hunting. And then it was funny because listening to Tim's story on your podcast, he mentioned, you know, I was into it as a child and then I fell away from it for a while. You know, and I did too. I got into my professional life and it wasn't till a few years that I kind of fell back into that lure of it and understanding the importance of it. And then I could apply it to my craft. So I had to, in my way of looking at it, I had to first kind of embed myself in culinary, embed myself in the history, anthropology, and science of food. And then I could reintroduce what I already knew as my foundation. And so that was kind of a great coming back to full circle for me. But yeah. And so, I mean, my dad grew up hunting whitetail in South Central Texas, had, you know, hog hunting. I still have his old Glenfield 3030 that I love to pull out, little cowboy gun of his. And it was, it really is a beautiful connection that we have with it.
So how did you then develop this interest in food, but then also this super in-depth interest in history and how they relate? Like, where did that come from?
So my mother actually is a pastor. And so with being somebody who's very good at not only gaining the attention for a good reason, not just the attention, but kind of being able to conduct herself in a room, my dad was a great storyteller. And so they're both great storytellers. And so what is history, but not just the storytelling of who we are, what we're doing, where we've been, what we've done. And so I've always loved history. I've absolutely loved it. And it's given me a lot of understanding of kind of where we are, where I am, all these things. And so I just applied the aspect of food to it because everybody eats. Everybody has that connection to it. And so we have found just in the years that we've been doing this at Gastronomy is that there are these firm connections. There are these corresponding lines that go between the people who eat just for sustenance, just eat just because they need to. But now they're looking at food in a different light. Food is now entertainment. Food is sexy. Food offers all these different things that before we just ate, you know? And now we're watching other people cook for us. And that's a very weird situation to be in. And so, yeah, when I look at the history of where our food has been, there are all these lines that keep coming up, and it's connecting all those. And that's kind of the way that I pull it all together, you know?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. As you're saying that, I was kind of thinking about just what we were talking about a minute ago. It's like, we were talking about, the barbacoa I was making out of that fallow deer, yeah. And then the elk and penne and cream sauce, mm-hmm. Elk sausage and penne pasta and cream sauce that I made the next day. And it really is. It's like a performance piece or an art form.
It is
nowadays, because like I was posting that all day long on my story, putting that together in the slow cooker.
Yeah.
And it's not a weird thing. Like, it's not a weird thing to do, especially when it's something like wild game. Mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, okay, a lot of people will post their meals. It's like a beautifully plated meal, all of that. Yeah. It's a really tasty meal.
Yeah.
But then it's taken to the next level when it's something like wild game. Like, sure. Would you agree?
I would, because, you know, it just kind of how I was talking about how the circle comes back around again. There is this now, because it's exotic, because it's something now that people are, for the longest time, our culture, our society didn't feel like we had access to. And it had a lot to do with the fact that hunting was for this very particular group of people. It was for this group of people who understood all these things, or it was part of the rural crowd. I'd much rather get conventional meat, because the killing of an animal has all of this negative stereotypes wrapped around it.
And as we know, conventional meat doesn't actually kill animals.
No animals. Those animals. Yeah. Those animals are completely healthy and happy, you know, that's a whole nother conversation, but it really is. It is this, people are now realizing, with grocery store shelves being emptied. We obviously in San Antonio got hit, just like everybody else did, and then just recently Texas got hit with a winter storm. So all of our meat completely just wiped out. You go into our grocery stores and everything's cleared out. But then you go into a hunter's home and you see what's in their freezer, and you see that they in a way have prepared themselves for this. But this is the common knowledge that we already knew. And I have a freezer right over here with game in it, and just like you do, that it's ready, it's available. And there's equity in that. There's you actually putting yourself into uncomfortable positions that wouldn't just be as easy as ordering Uber Eats and it coming straight to your door, you know? And we've disconnected ourselves because of the convenience. And now everybody watching you make barbacoa and watching you go through those steps, it now brings some of that equity back. And it shows that what we try to teach, especially with our game cooking, that not every piece of game has to be just chili. Doesn't have to be just sausage or dried jerky. You're making a very, very old school recipe, something that has been done in Mexico for hundreds of years, and you're doing it in your fashion. I mean, that right there is sexy. Watching somebody else cook on to TV is one thing, but watching somebody do their passion and actually break down this amazingly beautiful animal that they harvested themselves, that's connectivity in its best form. You know what I mean?
Well, and here's the thing, is like, everyone loves a good story. It doesn't matter what it is.
Right.
Like, say we were talking about knives earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, say I make a knife and I can go to someone, and I was actually talking with someone about this last night, another knife maker.
Sure.
And it's like, I could go to someone, I could pull out two identical knives, and I can be like, this one I built from, 5160 bar stock steel that I purchased. Da, 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 da.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's that one. This other one is like, I found this cool vintage store, and out back they had a bucket of old rusty railroad spikes that were part of the Southern Pacific Railroad.
That's
and,
right.
You know, I was able to take those before they threw them out, and I forged this from this old railroad spike. Which one is somebody going to buy?
That's true.
The one that has the cool history and the cool story behind it.
Yeah.
Or the just nice knife. Most likely they're going to go for the story. And I feel like a lot of that applies to cooking with, you know, just a store-bought steak versus your own wild game. Like,
yeah,
you have this really story behind it.
And it does. And I mean, and so when I talk about, I'm not necessarily putting down the showmanship of food that's now on display with, you know, Food Network and everything else. But I am looking at it in the sense of they've created a narrative around food that is no longer glorifying food as itself. What they are doing is they're telling story. They're doing the exact same thing you're doing, but they're doing it for ratings and they're no longer talking about the food. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is watch any cooking competition show and tell me that they're not sitting there trying to sell you on the actual story of the individual rather than, hey, look, this is the process they're doing in order to do this. It's no longer about that.
It's artificial. It's
Very much so.
You know, don't get me wrong. It's like I'll watch the heck out of those shows.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I mean, I want to bake the heck out of a pot de chez croquembouche tower. Like, yeah. Don't get me wrong. Like, I'll do that.
That's old school, but yeah.
Everyone listening to this was like, what the heck is this idiot talking about?
Everybody's getting on Google right now.
I got pulled into a lot of those like holiday baking shows. We won't go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah.
But it's like you said, it's the food in and of itself. It doesn't have that story. So they have to add that drama to create artificially create that story.
Right.
And I think it's like that with any reality TV show. Again, like anything you do, there's no real backstory here.
Of course.
They have to kind of artificially create one and add drama. And that's why everything has a time limit and they've got to do this in half the time you normally would. But
yeah. And it does. It adds drama. And then you have the backstory on the individual who's creating the drama. And all that stuff is lost. But the thing is that when it comes down to actual hunting and it comes down to cooking game, the drama is replaced by the actual process and the work it takes to go out and harvest the animal and the understanding, the lure of being in the terroir, actually being in its habitat, knowing its habitat, having the know-how to go dispatch that animal, bring it in and feed your family with it. And just like you were saying earlier, it's nuts that we've come back to this. We really have come back to the situation here where we're like, ooh, that's so romantic. Like, ooh, there's drama attached to that. Our ancestors are laughing at us going, that was my everyday. That was literally what I did every single day. And you're posting about it on Pinterest with your, you know, this is my favorite, you know, Sandhill Crane tamale recipe. And it's just, you know, it's great. And I love to see it go back there because it's something that needs to be focused on. But I really do appreciate those who take the time and understand the process and not just like, you know, just slap something on a plate and be like, oh, this is what I did. And this is my story. You know,
I've started trying to expand a little bit more because I do find myself where I find a couple of favorite recipes for sure.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And you know, I fall in love with those recipes because I know they're good and I'm trying to expand a little bit more. And especially now that I have a lot more game meat than I used to when it was limited, of course I'd use those very specific recipes because I didn't want to take the chance that I might make something I didn't like, but, you know, I would always prepare backstraps in the exact same way and they'd go in the sous vide. I mean, and don't get me wrong, still hard pressed to say those haven't been some of the best meals I've ever had.
Right.
But you know, now it's like, I'm experimenting. I'm making like taco soup or this cream pasta or various other things. And, we're just grilling up a good steak and it's fun to experiment, man. There's really so much joy involved in cooking.
Yeah.
My whole family has noticed it. They're like, we love it.
Yeah, of course.
when I was at home, they were like, we love it that Sam started hunting. That means he cooks all the time and it's really good.
And that really is. I mean, that is something that we teach, even outside the realm of game cooking, just cooking in general, that it's always a net positive. All of this is a net positive. You learning how to understand the process of preparing food for yourself and others can only benefit society as a whole. And there are many different avenues you can take if you want to focus on regional cuisine, you want to focus on more healthy food, you want to, any part of that is a net positive for everybody involved. And so, you know, I grew up in a family where we didn't eat out that much. And both my parents cooked. And we now see that the percentage of families who no longer cook, who eat out breakfast, lunch, and dinner is astronomical. And not to say that they're necessarily doing anything that they don't feel like they need to at that moment. But the fact is that knowledge of cooking is being lost. And for every generation that goes by, that part of that knowledge is gone. And so even with game cooking, I mean, how many people do what you and I do? I mean, it's not a lot, not a lot.
It's, I mean, most of the hunters I know are very similar to how I am most of the time, where they cook everything the same way. They've got sausage, they've got jerky, they've got grind, and then a couple of backstrap steaks or roast. Mm-hmm. They'll either wrap it in bacon or throw it on. It's always the same thing.
Yep.
And the rest is tacos and beef jerky, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like the majority of people are like that. There's nothing wrong with that, but
no, there's not at all.
It's, you know, I don't know. For me, sometimes I do that and I remind myself, I'm like, I've got like 200 more pounds of it in the freezer.
Sure. Sure.
I can get away with making spaghetti this one time with some elk grind.
Yeah, of course. But
I don't know. Like, I feel like I want to do justice. You know, it's the whole idea of this whole, through this whole process, you want to show respect for the animal, right?
Exactly.
I'm still in the mindset that doesn't stop the second when I pull it out or put it in the freezer.
Yes, true.
Like, I pull out that steak and I'm like, man, like, I feel like I need to do this justice.
Right.
You know, because also the amount of blood, sweat, and tears that went into that. Like,
yeah, that's true.
You know,
and that is a big fear with a lot of the, especially the new hunters that I speak to, especially at, when we were at FTW, there were a few there that were asking the questions of, well, here's the thing. I want to get into this lifestyle of hunting and I want to start focusing on, harvesting my own food and building a garden in the backyard and going out hunting. And that's my own safety net. And I'm building that for myself. And my issue with hunting though, is that I'm going to spend this time and this money and learning this craft and learning this understanding of all these things, having Larry Weissman there that talk about the biology and everything else, having the entire SAM crew work through training them on everything they need to do, spend the money in order to get the correct rifle, the correct optics, all this equipment that you need to go out and do it. You go harvest an animal, you bring it back, and then you overcook it. I mean, the first time you bring that into your kitchen, like you said, it's honoring that animal through every step of that process. And so what can easily happen is you get to the end of the process and you go, well, I'm not doing that again. Mm-hmm. Why would I? Because I got a backstrap and I overcooked it and oh my God. And I didn't put I didn't put enough fat in it. So it doesn't taste like what I'm used to tasting. And there is so much there that is that's lost because of that. And of course, why would people put in all that sweat and equity into something and then at the very end be disappointed? So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to offer them avenues in order to make those mistakes, but do it knowing that, hey, you know what, there are some steps you can take before you make those mistakes that you can actually learn from and unpack and be like, oh, okay, if I did this, because you undercook or overcook game, it's horrible. You got to cook it perfectly. You know, mm-hmm. There has to be a fat percentage. There has to be flavor, all those other things. But yeah.
So I've got to ask.
Yeah.
What's your opinion on the term gamey?
So gamey does come from the sense of more iron in the meat. If you have grass fed beef, a lot of people will tell you the exact same thing. They'll be like, "Ooh, this grass fed beef is gamey." Now, if it's grass fed grain finished, that's a different scenario, and that's why they do it. But it really is, the gaminess does come from the fat. The gaminess does come from the bones. If you were to have a piece of just pure meat with very or pure protein from an axis or, you know, anything else, you would pick up that gaminess because of the amount of iron and everything that's in it. But it would actually, there's ways to diffuse that. And you actually get to the point when you crave that flavor, you know? And I can tell you this, if you overcook, that gaminess comes out. If you undercook, that gaminess comes out. It's getting it at this perfect apex of flavor that you're and doneness that you're not in that territory of having that pronounced flavor. But for people who are just starting out and just starting to start cooking game, that's the biggest thing on their mind. It really, really is. Besides the fact that they did all this equity and they want to get to a good spot, they're also sitting there. 'Cause that's the first thing you think about, right? Mm-hmm. And when you think about game, you think about, oh, it's going to be gamey. It's going to be too much, you know? So yeah, that's kind of my outlook on it.
Well, it's funny to me is people use the term gamey. They'll use it to describe pronghorn,
yep.
Mule deer,
oh yeah,
yep. Like upland game, wild turkey, like literally everything across the board. I'm like, mm-hmm. Wow, it's amazing that all of these things can taste exactly the same.
Right. Like, right. And they're all eating different things because they're coming from different climates. The vegetation is completely different. What they're digesting. So it will, and it's a completely, they're just different animals altogether. Yeah. So saying that, oh, it's gaminess, it's really kind of, it's a lack of really kind of understanding what that flavor is and where it comes from and how to either work with that flavor in the sense of cooking or to kind of dilute it. And it's really a lot of the reasons why when you cut with conventional pork fat, you know, wild boar or anything else like that, not only that, it's just not a lot of fat.
Yeah.
Fat equals flavor all the time. So,
well, it's just funny to me. It's like, okay, you know, you buy a pork chop. Is a pork chop suddenly gamey because it doesn't taste like a beefsteak?
Yeah. I can see that, but pork is a little bit sweeter and it comes down to what it is that they eat. Those pigs are eating nothing similar to what their ancestors or the wild boar that are running all through Texas right now are eating.
Well, and I guess I should say, is all I'm trying to get at is like a different animal's going to taste different.
Oh, that's true.
There is to a certain extent. Yes. There's a thread that runs through wild game of that higher iron content, like you mentioned.
Sure.
But if you shoot an elk and expect to take like the exact same cut off an elk and a cow,
yeah,
and eat them side by side with no thought for preparation, of course they're going to taste different.
That's true.
And I mean, maybe you can speak to more of this about how our palates have developed to now expect, you know, a nice fatty beefsteak or something like right. that tastes like versus something that's lean and probably prepared differently. And you could probably speak to the history of that a little bit better than I can.
Well, I mean, it's the observation that you can go into any modern supermarket and you see cows that are pretty much fed with the same type of grain, except with the exclusion of grass-fed, grain-finished, grass-fed grain or grass-fed grass finish, but that's what's readily available. And so if it's readily available, that's what all recipes start to focus on. If it's what all recipes start to focus on, the market is going to start putting out more and more of this conventional beef, more conventional pork, more conventional chickens, poultry. And what will happen is we will always, as human beings, go to the path of least resistance. We will go to what is easier, what is more marketable, what kind of is how quick can we get those calories on our plate without having to expend a ton of energy. And so what ends up happening is you can go to the grocery store right now and you can look around and that's what you see. And there is that disconnect of, okay, well, I'm used to these flavors now because of the amount of fat that's in it, and what they feed gives the flavor of the meat what I'm used to, and where we don't necessarily branch out when it comes to food
as much anymore. Everybody has their lane they like to stick into. They find, like we said earlier, they find different types of food sexy when it's on a plate. But when it really comes down to it, adventurous eaters, we're not. And so wild game is something that's outside the realm of a lot of people's understanding. And like I said, it's not only that, it's like, even when they tiptoe into it, they're then terrified of making a mistake. So, but yeah, that's the way I kind of see it, is that what is conventional is readily available. What is readily available will always be at the forefront of what they're purchasing and how they're cooking and everything. The whole market is set up for that. The whole market is not set up for wild game.
Whether you're just looking to stay warm during a hunt or need maximum concealment, the clothing you wear can make or break a hunt. At MidwayUSA.com, we understand hunting clothing has come a long way, with more meticulously crafted camo patterns, advanced scent control technologies, and weatherproof options to withstand the elements. Hunters have to wait until their favorite season, but shouldn't wait on gear, which is why MidwayUSA offers super fast shipping. When you're ready for your next system, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
I I'm sure you get it all the time too, that some people come to you and like, I will, you know, yeah, I'll try some wild game, but I will not eat venison. I will not eat venison. I hate the taste of venison, or da 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 da. And usually my response, and you got to be delicate with this, because sometimes you're just insulting someone's grandfather.
That's true.
I'm like, in not so many words, I usually tell them, I'm like, hey, well, that's probably because whoever made it for you, mm-hmm. either didn't know how to shoot the animal correctly, didn't know how to field process the animal correctly, didn't know how to take care of the meat correctly, or didn't know how to cook it correctly.
That's true.
One of four things here, because I guarantee if they cooked it right, if all that other stuff is present, they cooked it right.
Yeah.
You probably wouldn't even know it was wild game, because there's so many ways, like that barbacoa.
Yeah.
I have so many dang jalapenos and chipotle peppers and stuff in that. I mean, it is a giant bowl of chipotle, which is freaking awesome.
I love it.
I've done it with javelina. I've done it with whitetail. I've done it with fallow deer.
Yeah,
it is literally tastes almost exactly the same every single time.
I love it. Yeah. I mean, and there's so many ways, like we were talking about, just using conventional hunting recipes, quote unquote, kind of thing. That's one thing that, think about the ingredients in chili. Like when you think of ground venison, you talk to most American hunters and you say, hey, I have ground venison, what should I do with it? They're all going to say, hey, turn into chili, man. So what is chili? Chili is aromatics and onions and garlic. Okay. Then it's beans. If you're from Texas, there are no beans or you get shot. I mean that. after that, it's spices, tons and tons of spices. And so you add all these things to it. And at the end, does it even taste like venison? So what you said is accurate, because you lose the honor, in my opinion, of giving it to that animal when you just treat it like anything else, in the sense of you cover the flavors up. You need to allow those, flavors and those textures to shine. And you go into it pretty much knowing, hey, game, not going to come out like a tenderloin. A tenderloin on a beefsteak tenderloin is that way for a reason, because of the anatomy of the steer. And that same tenderloin on an elk is not going to, don't sit there and be surprised when it comes out tasting and having a different texture, different than what you expected. I mean, they're just different animals, but you know, covering it in something so you just don't taste the flavor, I think you're kind of losing the point of it. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying, like, if that's all that we know of game cooking, we've kind of missed the mark a little bit.
Well, and that's even that relates to kind of what we were chatting about earlier when I was making the bone broth. We were kind of messaging back and forth on Instagram, and I was about to use that bone broth for the barbacoa. They put broth in there, and I'm like, you know what? Why would I do that? Mm-hmm. This is like some solid bone broth. And I was kind of lazy. I didn't make the sheep and the fallow deer serve. I just threw all the bones in at once.
Sure.
And nice multicultural bone broth.
Yeah. Of course.
multi-animal bone broth. But,
so all inclusive bone bro.
There we go. There we go. It's you know, it's the ideal of the world.
Yeah, that's true.
All represented in my bone broth. Yeah. But so I made this bone broth and I was going to use it in this recipe, but I'm like, why would I do that? I can use chicken broth in that and it'll be fine. I want to use that bone broth for something like a soup or making like a pho or something where it's like that bone broth is the central, is one of the central components of it. And you're actually tasting that and getting all that value out of it. It's like, I feel like we need to learn to cook again, not to make whatever meat we have or whatever, whatever like supply we have, it tastes like what we want it to taste like, but instead we should cook to enhance the, to highlight and enhance the flavor of whatever meat we have. It's just switching how we're thinking about it.
Yeah, that's very true. And I don't want it to get lost that not using every bit of the animal isn't one of the most important pillars of hunting. And taking the bones and using them accordingly and roasting them and creating a brown stock like you did, and taking that time and then using that brown stock in the sense of just adding it to a soup or doing something like that to where that flavor is now masked by bolder, more pronounced flavors. That's not a bad thing. I don't want that to get confused, but I see what you're saying, because while I was watching you put together the stock, I'm sitting there going, you know what? I wonder what a fallow deer consomme would taste like. If you were to actually concentrate those flavors and do it in a manner that, like, I mean, it's an old school way of creating a purified soup. But if you were to do that and actually get the purified flavor, the rendering of all that flavor out of those bones, what would that taste like? And I almost sent you a message and asked you, hey man, why don't you try a consomme? Why don't you, like, you know, I'd love to see how that turns out, you know?
So is that something I can still make after the fact?
Oh yeah, very much okay. So.
I thought so. Cause I'm literally Googling it right now as we're talking. Yeah, yeah.
So it's a purified stock. So, I mean, the difference between broth and stock is broth is usually the addition of animal protein and its bones. That's broth, and then stock is just the bones. And so a consomme would be taking either one of those and creating what's called a raft, which is it's usually ground up meat. You can use eggshells, you can use bread, you can use whatever, and you put it on top and you allow all the impurities to cling to that raft, and you let it barely, you don't even let it boil, you let it barely simmer. And I mean, this is old school culinary stuff. And at the very end, you take it off. And you have this, you have a broth that you can see through. You have a stock that you can see through, but it's a concentration of those flavors, and it's pure, and it's, you know, it's a beautiful flavor if done correctly. So
what then, what would be like an appropriate use for a fallow deer red sheep consomme?
Oh my God. So what I would do is I would take some of that ground fallow. I really would. Make a ravioli. So fresh pasta, serious fresh pasta, good ricotta, you know, roasted garlic. I mean, some really, really good ingredients. And then go through with a really good ravioli recipe. Quail eggs. If you get your hands on some good quail eggs, make that ravioli, the ravioli stuffing, fold that ground fallow or fold any type of game meat into it, and then drop that egg yolk, right? That or a duck egg. Oh my God. Duck eggs. Don't even get me started on duck eggs. but if you take that and you, you just build a ravioli in there, and then you would actually cook the ravioli, put it just straight on a bowl, and then pour that consomme on top of it. Oh my God. Put some aromatics, like fresh herbs or something like that. Oh dude, come on now. Come on now.
We are getting bougie up in here. Yeah, man. This is some good stuff.
Yeah. But I love it because, again, it's not chili. It's not jerky. It's not sausage. I love anybody who's ever met me knows that I don't have a problem making sausage. It's my heritage. I adore it.
Yeah.
But no, it is something to be said that you're elevating game cuisine. You're elevating the understanding. And you talk about actually honoring that animal that gave its life so that you could eat, and you reciprocated it in kind by using every bit of the animal and then doing something that's just, because that right there is what's going to get the attention of the common person as far as game cuisine. Because if you go out slinging chili and sausage and jerky at everybody, everybody's going to be like, yeah, I know, this is game cuisine. But you start doing like a fallow deer pho, come on, that rattles people's cages and it gets them excited about it.
And I mean, you know, I've got some steaks that I could cut into some nice thin slices for that.
Yeah.
Ah, shoot, man. I don't have enough time for all this cooking.
I know.
I'm gonna have all of the, I'm gonna be like, oh, you know, I want to make some different today. I'm gonna have all of these leftovers. I'm gonna need to start inviting people over for this stuff.
Yeah. I'll be on a plane tomorrow, bro.
anytime.
Yeah, man.
So, you know, we were talking a little bit about, like, kind of honestly, all of the places in the process things can go wrong, where that can kind of make the meat, make your what you're harvesting kind of take a little bit of a turn for the south, or maybe pick up some additional unnecessary gamey flavor.
Of course.
What are some maybe tips along the line? If somebody's going down the line, they shoot their animal.
Yeah.
What are some tips as we go along the line for that, that meat prep, that meat care? You know, obviously, like, we could sit and we did do an entire class solely on skinning and quartering, and you can do an entire class solely on each section of this, but maybe some highlights from each section, things for new hunters to be aware of as they're in the field preparing this meat and taking it home with them to then process or take to a game processor.
Sure. I mean, it really does come down. I mean, so let's start with the actual dispatching of the animal. Let's start with the actual hunting portion of it. Knowing that one shot, one kill is the goal, knowing that that is that's your overall objective, is to glorify that animal with the least amount of suffering as possible. And also, not so much in the case of you bringing me a heart to make ceviche out of, which was awesome.
Oh my gosh. That was probably my favorite part of the weekend was that ceviche.
Yeah. I honestly saw that on, I saw that on Meat Eater, and I was like, oh man, as soon as you came around the corner with it, I honestly thought that you, I don't know if I told you this, I thought you cut your finger, because you came around and you had it in your hand and it was just still fresh. And I'm like, oh, Sam, what happened, man?
That story was so great, because I come in, I'm like, hey, and you guys all look at me like, what the hell happened?
And I didn't see the heart. All I saw was your hand and blood. And I was like, oh, man, the whole thing was
wrapped up in paper towels. And it's literally like, it's kind of, the paper towels kind of falling around my hand. So it looks like I just like wrapped my whole hand in this giant bloody paper towel. And this heart was still warm.
Oh yeah.
Literally, we just pulled it out, and I come running in, and I'm like, hey guys. And you guys just all looked at me like, why are you in here? Like, what? Go to the first aid kit.
Like, yeah, something.
Let's just talk about that for a second, because I roll in with that. I'm like, what can we do with this heart? Because all of the other animals, we had a few that were heart shot, but most of the other ones, we didn't focus on anything but the main quarters, because it's a beginner's class. And honestly, let's face it, I feel like that's kind of step two for most people is getting into the, you know, the heart and the liver and
the awful parts of it. Not awful as in bad, but awful as in the organs and everything else. What do you do with all that? And it's a good question to ask. My doctor gets most of my organ meat. He feeds his dogs with it. Dog couldn't be happier. It's eating like it's supposed to. And in a situation like this, I mean, I had seen other people do that. And I was like, you know what, this is what better chance to, to try it out, man. Cause we had, readily available, line of wild game coming in. And as soon as we had that ceviche, we all kind of looked at each other and I mean, we took it out. There's a picture. Did you, I think you took it or somebody did, of me feeding Larry Weissman.
It's the video of you like dumping it in his, cause I came out, like I took that first bite. You brought it out. That's right. We were out processing, you finished it, brought it out, and I took that first bite on video because I'm like, we'll see. Like I didn't know if I was gonna hate it. Like I've had ceviche like twice in my life, and so I had it was great, and Larry's like, well, I want in on this too. But he was like up to his elbows because he had been teaching how to skin and quarter for the past 2 hours. So that video is great of him tipping his head back and you dumping it.
He had such a good time. And I love Larry so much because he was like, oh man, well I've, you know, taken a bite out of a heart before just to prove a point that it can be eaten. And I guess that's even my wife, when I was like, hey, you know, she's like, so how was everything? And I told her and I was like, oh man, and she saw what I was posting and she was like, I just don't know about it. I just, you know, that's something. And so there has to be, and I guess this is a roundabout way of answering your question you originally asked. There has to be an understanding of, because you're not going to treat a hind quarter like you are a tenderloin. You're going to be very disappointed. There's a lot more connective tissue in a hind quarter than, or a ham or any other part, than there is a tenderloin. So cooking it, respectfully to the methods that will produce the better outcome is unbelievably crucial. And then looking at it in the sense of, okay, well, what recipes am I comfortable with? Do you like stir fry? Okay, great. Well, take the correct cuts of meat, stir fry those, and then duplicate a recipe that you're comfortable with. Going and as for a new hunter and going out and actually, you know, harvesting the animal and bringing it back and having this game sit there in your kitchen and you go, okay, I got to understand this as well as a new recipe. That's too much. That's a lot to unpack all at once. And a lot of people are doing this exact same thing, even without game, they're doing it with conventional proteins and they're getting disappointed. No wonder a lot of people don't cook is because they put all this time and effort into it. But, at every step of the process, like we said, you want a heart shot. If you don't get a heart shot, put dice the heart up and put it in lime juice, cure it. You dice it pretty small. I mean, come on now. That turned out really good. We were
all I gotta say is I took that heart and everyone was like looking at me like I'm an idiot. And I took it in and then I came back and I'm like, sweet, he's going to make some ceviche. And everyone in that room, there was like 10, 15 people in that room were all like, oh yeah, well you have fun with that.
Yeah.
We don't want anything to do with it.
It was gone in 15 minutes.
Oh my God. And
it was gone.
Did we ever end up making a second batch?
Well, I was back the next week to cook for another group to walk some Navy SEALs through cooking and processing. And I got three Axis hearts when I was out there. I'm sorry, one black buck and two Axis hearts.
Yeah.
And I did the exact same thing with it. And these guys are the top of the top. I mean, these are the Navy SEALs and they're out there doing their training. And they even looked at it. They even were like, I don't know.
Whoa, bro.
Yeah, hold on a second. Like I'll storm any beach and protect, you know, our liberties, but eating a lime cured heart that's where I draw the line, brother. But the moment they had it, it went, and those guys can eat. Let me tell you, those guys can eat. And so what ended up happening was we just burned through it. And I think there's something to be said about that. There's something to be said about not only trying new things, but doing so not so haphazardly, not just running into a situation going, oh, this will turn out just like I expected. But you put in the time, equity, money, and all the stuff in the hunting, you got to make the right call.
Well, and let's be clear here. Like, I think, you know, you kind of touched on this, but we're not saying like, okay, you're a first time hunter and maybe you don't cook much at home. we're not expecting you to go out and again, make a a whitetail consomme with quail eggs. And
yeah,
I mean, don't get me wrong. If that's what gets your, if that's what floats your boat and gets, you know, gets your gears turning, whatever, yeah. Like, heck yeah, go try it. Try it with realistic expectations. Like if sure. you've never like really cooked before, and especially if you never really eaten wild game before.
Right.
Okay. Maybe at that point, yeah. Start with some chili, start sure. with, you know, make some sausage, you know, try some like well marinated steaks, things like that, that are a little more straightforward, and work your way into the process. So sure. again, doing honor to that animal, because if you hop in with 2 feet and you completely destroy something, you're not doing any more honor to that than just throwing it out at that point. So
no, it's very true. That's very true. Yeah. And that's really a good protocol for really anything in life, is to actually just try it, but going into it with clear expectations and kind of a clear goal will always give you a better outcome than if you're just either haphazard or worst of all, you don't do anything at all. Mm-hmm. So you never have those chances. And I think that other ways of kind of setting yourself up for success would really be, in cooking, we have a term called mise en place. Mise en place quite literally translates into everything in its place in French. The backbone of all modern culinary is French cooking and the understanding of French cooking. And what you see with mise en place is that you see that everything is within your reach. And so you're setting yourself up for success by putting, and every good cook knows this, you're not going to spend a lot of time, gathering your recipes as you're cooking, because I mean, that just invites so many different types of mistakes. And in this situation, you definitely don't want to have those mistakes, but what is great is, not only harvesting the animal in a way that gives it honor and does it justice as far as you doing the entire process, but treating it in between each stage, drying it properly before freezing it, fabricating it, like actually cutting up the animal in a way that you know that those cuts are going to be best suited for what you're doing, like your barbacoa. If that was in tiny little pieces, you wouldn't have gotten the same, I guess, melting of connective tissue as you were if it was one large piece. And so going into it and just kind of like, okay, well, I'm just going to kind of figure it out. You do need to have this knowledge of the, you know, kind of the basics of cooking, even outside the realm of game. And I think that's important. And then once it's on your cutting board, once you're in the thick of it and you're actually having to walk through a recipe, take your time. My God, enjoy the process. Spend time, you know, in my kitchen. Every time I'm cooking in my kitchen at home, we're playing music, man. We really are. It really is a place that you want to be. Cooking's not a chore. It shouldn't be a chore. It should be something you enjoy. And there's that romance with hunting now that we have, and there's that kind of bringing it all together to feed your family. There's a connection to our lineage and to our heritage that I think has been lost for a long time.
Oh yeah.
So yeah.
So we totally got off track.
No, I have a tendency to do that.
Which I absolutely love. Those are the best conversations.
Sure.
But what are maybe some of the other points of failure along the process where mm-hmm. people are most likely to, I mean, effectively end up with some extra gamey meat. So maybe, you know, you've got the animal, you want to make as quick and clean of a shot as humanly possible.
True.
Because all of that stress and adrenaline and all of that pumping through the animal can affect the taste of the meat, correct?
That's very true. That's very true. My goodness. So we talked earlier about fat equaling flavor. So, doing a good percentage of fat into any type of game cooking will give you a better overall outcome. Obviously pork fat and beef fat are good options. But with those, there obviously needs to be a good percentage.
because if there is a lot of fat, that's just no good for anybody. And it can help with the gaminess. It can offer other flavors that kind of, like we said earlier, dilute those gamey flavors that you're not necessarily too keen on if you're brand new to cooking game. But and then aromatics, spices, everything else. I think the first night we did at FTW for the new hunter experience, we did a green Thai axis. So we took an axis quarter and we cut it down and we fried it. We did it on a wok seared. And then we did a green Thai curry with it with vegetables. And I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with adding a sauce and everything else because you could still taste the axis. It wasn't something so pronounced and so covered in spice. It was something that every time you took a bite, there was. I mean, axis is one of the. I mean, up near Neil Guy, it's probably one of my favorite game to cook. But yeah, I think that adding fat, adding flavor, focusing on these different points within flavor, adding citrus brings brightness to a recipe. Adding that in a way that doesn't make it so that it's completely overbearing. Not in the case of curing a heart with citrus, because it's a whole different thing. So, but yeah.
That's actually something I've started doing a lot more of, is adding either just like a half a lime or half a lemon to something. Yeah. You know, again, going back to this ground elk with, in the penne and cream sauce, it's got some red peppers in it that just adds a little bit of heat. And, you know, that sausage already has a little bit of spiciness to it. But adding that lemon in, it just does. It brightens it up and it adds that little citrusy note to it that kind of it's so stinking good. This is a recipe I stole from, we were talking HelloFresh back when I did those HelloFresh meals.
Yep.
And I kept all of those things. And I just remember I was eating one. I'm like, you know, this would be really epic with spicy elk sausage instead of this like random, you know, Italian sausage that they send you with it. And
yeah,
so I made sure that one was the one that got like bookmarked for sure. Yeah, and
of course.
And I think there's so many people, again, we fall into the trap of these are our wild game recipes. These are our other thing recipes. Mm-hmm. There's so many recipes that you can look at. And yeah, you may have to modify them slightly. Like you said, either add more fat because it's a leaner meat or adjust some flavors to account for a different, you know, to open it up a little bit more. But you know, why can't you make, make red sheep tamales I mean, all kinds of other things that, and I think, again, it's just altering how we go about it, how we think about it. And like, looking at a recipe being like, okay, how can I integrate wild game into this instead of just like, okay, I've got this wild game. What's my recipe for it sometimes? And you know, coming at it from all different directions, and I enjoy this shit.
Yeah. And it's a balance. It's what you know and how you know it, how you can incorporate it. And flavor and taste are two different things, but how we actually kind of pull flavor apart and better understand it is that, you know, the fat and sugar and sodium and all these things put together gain this better understanding of flavor and how the endorphins and how, you know, dopamine receptors and everything starts happening that we go, oh, this is something I like. And then you add texture and then you add citrus or acidity and you add these different levels of flavor and it makes it more complex. And in a sense of tasting anything like a red sheep tamale, it will have those markers within it that causes us to be like, oh, this is something I want to do again, you know, because if it was flat, didn't have any fat, no one goes back to that because there's no flavor. And that's, I mean, everybody loves eating. And so when there's no flavor there, like really, what's the point? So we lose it pretty quickly.
Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At Midway USA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
So let's maybe go through just a couple of, just to give some people a little bit of inspiration, some ideas. Let's maybe go through a few different animals, like some common, you know, a lot of my audience are Western hunters, you know,
sure,
out here hunting mule deer and elk and, you know, definitely some whitetail and stuff like that. So maybe a couple of suggestions for some recipes. You know, we don't have to go through and detail them step by step, but like, so say elk, you know, you get an elk, you want to talk about some loins on an animal.
Oh, like, yeah.
The freaking tenderloins on an elk are about the size of the full loin on some other animals.
Yeah, man.
But, you know, say I got an elk loin, an elk backstrap. I got the whole dang thing. What would be some good cuts for that? And maybe like a good meal that you think would be awesome for somebody to try out for the first time.
So anytime you're talking about a tenderloin of any animal, be it, you know, a cow, pig, you know, elk, any type of wild game like that, the tenderloin itself, and this is kind of breaking down the science of it, and then I'll introduce the flavor part of it. Because of what the muscle group actually does for the animal, there's not a lot of fat. Right. There's not a lot of connective tissue. And whenever you have those cuts of meat, they require a different type of cooking than other parts of the animal. And what I mean by that is that the muscle groups are all in one direction. And you've known, even in as tender as a tenderloin can be, if you cut it with the grain, it's still going to be kind of tough. You cut it against the grain, you cut up those muscle fibers and you cut it into steaks, it becomes much more tender. So that takes care of the texture part of it. But with a tenderloin, you want to cook it in a fashion of, one, you're introducing fat, because there's not a lot of fat in a tenderloin, even on a beefsteak. But you want to do it in a way that that fat imparts flavor, and you want to cook it in a manner that is pretty quick. So what I would do is the caul fat, the actual leftover caul fat. I would take that and wrap the outside of it. This is actually creating very much kind of like a pocket of fat on the outside. And as it cooks, it'll actually seep into it.
So really quick, anybody that's ever watched an episode of Meat Eater knows what caul fat is.
Oh yeah, but of course.
For those that have not seen, you know, not ever watched an episode of Meat Eater on Netflix and have no idea what caul fat is, run through what that is really quick. Cause I think initially somebody's just going to assume like, oh, this is a chunk of fat, right?
No. Okay. Yeah. So, it's actually a netting of fat that is bound. If you were to hold it up, it looks pretty crazy, but it wraps around the stomach and it has a lot of connective fat tissue between it. And then just using that as a way to kind of seal the outside. It's the difference between larding and barding. And you would wrap the outside of it and it would encase it. So it almost seals. Meat Eater and the Meat Eater cookbook, they actually do one, they do meatballs with it, which is a great process of taking lean meat and incorporating fat and just that way. And it creates this nice little pocket on the outside of it. So, but yeah, it's night and day, it'll add flavor, but with something like an elk tenderloin, a good seasoning on the outside, treat it just like a really, really good steak. Cook it over open coals, what I would do, or wood fire. And don't overcook it, man. As soon as you overcook that, you're having a bad day.
Yeah. I was going to say, definitely always keep that, about 10 degrees rarer than you think you should.
Yeah, that's true. And there's also a little bit of cooking science here. There's also carrier cooking. So if you're looking at it to be 140 degrees when it comes off of the grill, it's going to be at 145, 150 within only a matter of moments, because that that heat is still that heat is still within that steak and it's still climbing. So that's why we suggest doing sous vide. Sous vide is using a water oven or a water bath with a element that circulates and heats the water perfectly. So you can set a sous vide at the perfect temperature, plus or minus 1 degree, and it'll keep it there for a long time. You just have to keep it in a food saver bag or, you know, mm-hmm. under pressure. It does a great job for that. And then you just finish it on the grill. And it's super simple. So
those are my absolute two favorite ways. I've done like a dry rub on a big old elk roast, backstrap elk roast. Yeah. Bring it up to temp really slowly. This is something I learned from the guys over at Birch Barrel, but bring it up to temp super slowly, like 5 minutes on, 5 minutes off, minutes on. And then you just straight wood coals, 100% wood coals. And it's got that nice crust, and we just finish it directly on the coals.
Oh yeah. Oh man.
My gosh. And everybody that sees me do this, and I was talking about this with my neighbors the other day, they're like, why would you do that to a perfect? They were like horrified. They see me like cut it open and try it, and they're like, Oh, I get it now.
Yeah. There is something to be said about the Maillard reaction that comes from a good char on the outside of it. We know this in Texas because of our brisket. We get a really mm-hmm. good smoke ring on the outside of our brisket. Which by far is the the best barbecue in the country. Let's just say that. I'll take anybody to task for that. I don't even care. But we know that the cooking and that's through smoke. But a good char on the outside of protein introduces these levels of flavors that you really don't get anywhere else. And throwing it directly on the coals, you know, really does invite that super quick, man. It's super quick. And I love it. I absolutely love it.
And I'd also, the sous vide is one of the greatest purchases I've ever made in my life. Oh my gosh. I'll do like an overnight marinade and then, in the sous vide for like 4 hours, get to that perfect temperature, and you just heat up that cast iron pan till it's sizzling.
Oh yeah, man.
Sear it on there. And then, all those drippings make like a perfect, like you add some cream and some garlic or something, turn that into a little sauce with a drizzle over the top.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So the, one of the times that I was out at FDW and I was cooking for those folks, we had a really good group out there, and, we got our hands on about 20, maybe, I don't know, 25, sandhill crane breasts.
Ooh.
And I mean, these things they're just beautiful. Fat content, everything about them is great. So, I put them with aromatics, garlic and shallots, and just put them in the sous vide, let them go. And then by the time we took them out, we dried them and we encrusted them. So there's a company here in San Antonio called Texas Black Gold Garlic that we do a lot of work with. They're one of our, kind of partner companies. And, we use a lot of what they do, and they have a fermented garlic product that is roasted. Steven, who runs the place, actually roasts these things, you know, for a really long time, and they create this beautiful aromatic, rich garlic flavor. And so they had a rub. They have actually a blackening season that has this black garlic in it. It's dried. We took those sandhill crane breasts, man, and we encrusted them and then finished them in a hot cast iron, which is really the only way you could be doing this is in a cast iron skillet. And we seared off these 20-25 sandhill crane breasts, and we did it with a Scheinerbach Bernays, which was just a lot of fun. And
that's about as like local as you get right there, man.
Oh yeah, I mean, the sandhill crane came from the Panhandle. This time was right around sandhill crane or sandhill season, and the gentleman who brought it in, we're super super proud to see it. I was super proud to be a part of it. And I walked into Tim Fallon's office, and Tim's one of my favorite people, because I go walking in there and I nearly put it like straight in front of him. I was like, here, I just here. And he goes, what is this? And I was like, man, stop asking questions. Just enjoy deep. It. And he took one bite of it, and he sat there and he goes, is this the sandhill? And I go, yeah. Oh my God. And I honest to God, I was, there were so many chances for us to screw that up, for me to screw that up. But again, I just took my time. I looked at it. I knew the process. And this is my first time cooking sandhill in that context. And actually walking through that. And yeah, that was something that I've just, everybody was like, oh man, I can't believe we pulled that off. That was a lot of fun. So yeah, but yeah, it's, yeah, just inviting those different types of methods is something that can really translate into success. So,
okay. So we got spring season coming up for a lot of places around the US here. Got some challenges for you here. We'll start with the easy one first.
Okay.
We got wild turkey.
Yeah.
Breast out. I literally just posted a video today from my first time processing and quartering out a wild turkey. And we got a couple of really good breasts. We got some legs. Depending on the turkey, might be able to get some off the wings. With wild turkey,
not. It's hard. Yeah. Especially the Easterns. You get those Easterns, they just not.
They just little spindly arms. They skipped arm day. But so, I got a couple of wild turkey breasts and a pair of wild turkey legs. What's something I could kind of think about doing with that?
So with the turkey legs, I would actually, oh my goodness, you could do quite a bit, but stick them in a crock pot, cook them long and low. I mean, long and low.
Yeah.
And then cook off all that connective tissue there. With the breast, what I really enjoy doing is a roulade. And so a roulade is essentially taking it, and it's kind of hard to explain it on a podcast without a video, but what you would do is you would actually fillet it out. So you would let the knife do a majority of the work, and you would get it to where you would expand that protein further and further out with the knife by essentially unrolling it. That's the best way I can explain it. And then taking, herbs, fresh herbs, garlic, onions, and then placing that all in there and then rolling it back up. So if you've ever had a pinwheel steak, this is essentially what they do with a sirloin. And and then truss it, and then let that smoke, on a barbecue pit or just a good braise. Again, not a lot of fat. So you have to introduce fat where you can. And this can be done by obviously wrapping the outside with bacon or anything else like that. Mm-hmm. But that's what I would do. I would just take it easy on it.
I've done some really good ones. I've had some really good ones like that where they add some cream cheese in there too. And then wrap the outside. Yeah. I mean, it's like a wild turkey cinnamon roll.
And the way I look at that, and I'm like, that sounds good, but it's kind of just cheating, man. It's just like cream cheese. It is so much fat, so much flavor. And I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying man, it's kind of like putting butter on everything. You put butter on everything to mask the flavors, and it's just because it's fat, it's fat. So yeah.
I did with that wild turkey and I need to echo with those legs. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking like 12 hours in the crock pot.
Oh, right? long time because the connective tissue is so, so strong right there. So
yeah, there, I noticed there especially, and it's that silver skin is really, really tough on those. It's almost impossible to get it off too. It took a long time, but I made a wild from the Meat Eater cookbook, actually.
The wild turkey
pozole.
Yep.
And that was pretty tasty. I made the mistake of, so I shouldn't say I made the mistake of brining it first. I love brining stuff beforehand. It just feels like it cleans it out, makes the meat a little bit cleaner and softens it up. Oh
yes, it does. Yeah.
But then I had forgotten that I'd brined it overnight.
Right.
And I fully salted everything before it went in the pan, and man, that was, I ended up having to add a lot of broth to that later. Yeah. But I digress. All right, here's the big challenge for you.
All right, send it.
I just shot my first black bear this spring season.
Hey, really?
Well, I love it. That's the goal. I'm setting up the scene here for the future.
Oh, okay. You got me all excited for nothing, Sam. You can't be doing that.
Well, have that reaction in a month or two when I shoot my first black bear.
I will.
I will call you up, and so this can that reaction can be authentic. Say I just shot my first black bear.
Yeah.
What am I looking forward to with this black bear?
So a lot of fat. Is going to not, you're not going to have a fat problem, with black bear. Full disclosure, I haven't had the honor of cooking black bear just yet. But I do know that you can treat those, a lot of those steaks the same way. The connective tissue is very similar, but because of the fat cap and because of, and obviously spring, you're looking at a different fat content because they're coming off of hibernation and everything else. Man, I really would do a braise. So do something. So braising is essentially searing the outside of it and then allowing it to cook in a poaching liquid for a good long while. Again, connective tissue, man. And this is the reason why brisket's so good. This is the reason why people love ribs, is because of all that connective tissue cooks down and turns into gelatin. And that gelatin is what gives it that mouthfeel that these larger cuts of meat are so well known for. And so I'd find a really great recipe just centered around good red wine. Canned tomatoes are where it's at. Don't use fresh tomatoes. You lose out on flavor when you use fresh tomatoes. Do a mirepoix of celery, carrots, and onions. And a nice long and low cooking process, man. And just let those fats meld into it. Sear the outside with a good amount of, just a really good amount of dried herbs. You always add dried herbs at the beginning of the process. You add fresh herbs at the end. So, good red wine, save some for yourself. Yeah.
That's then, the best part about cooking with wine.
It really is, man.
You know,
beer
and wine. You can't just open one. You got to open one for the food, one for yourself, you know?
That's very true. Yeah. and then cook it until it starts to pull apart, all those connective tissues and all that silver skin and everything kind of melts down and it kind of permeates through the meat, and that protein gets a ton of flavor. So that's all, honestly, what I would like to see you do. It wouldn't be as quick as a barbacoa because you're talking about a little bit bigger cuts of meat. The muscle groups look different. Everything looks different, but the fat, and again, the gaminess, the gaminess is going to be there a little bit more pronounced because there's going to be more fat included in that. So, but a nice long cooking process, just allow it to just fall apart. And then, oh my God, just finish it off with some fresh herbs, some good fresh basil or something like that. I think it'd be good eating right there.
There we go. And you know what, if I end up getting one and you end up, coming out to Montana for, you know, we were talking, you might be coming out for an event.
Yeah.
We may have to pull out the black bear sometime. And,
oh man, I would love to do a cooking segment with that. I think that you and I both unpacking that together over a couple of beers would be some good entertainment.
It'd be a lot of fun. It really would.
It's all about having fun. It's all about, getting to the point when you can really have fun after learning the process, more or less, and just, you know, game cooking is, it's a beautiful thing, man. You just gotta take your time.
And, you know, we touched on it, but here it is again. Like, we've talked a lot about, like, oh, you need to do honor to the animal and you should really be cooking and this and that. And to some extent, we've made it sound a little bit stressful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But just, you know, like you were saying, this should all be so much fun. You should be taking joy out of this, out of eating the food and I mean, sample everything along the way. You know, you're processing that meat,
right?
Make up a little compote butter, you know, some garlic and butter compote, throw it in the pan and just fry up a little piece and taste what you're processing. Cut off a little thin slice of, oh my gosh, we were talking about this earlier, cut off a little thin slice of that backstrap.
Yep.
You know, if it's a bear, don't do this.
Yeah, no.
If it's,
oh, no.
You know, if
no.
It's like, if it's an elk or deer and you know them, you know, you took care of the meat.
Sure.
Cut off a real thin slice of that, put just some thick ground cracked pepper on there. Yeah, some of that fresh ground Himalayan salt, man.
Yep.
Eat that little teeny slice raw. It's like, it'll get that pop in your mouth.
Oh, yeah.
So good. Have fun. Sample stuff.
Yeah. And
put on some music, dance around the kitchen like an idiot. I know I do.
Yeah, man.
Find some joy.
I make a living off of dancing around the kitchen like an idiot. Yeah. And what you're saying is right, because, you know, trying out raw ingredients and everything else. It's I wouldn't do it with black bear. I wouldn't do it with, you know, wild turkey, but you know, I would definitely, you know, in a situation like elk, you know, or the backstrap of a whitetail or axis. I mean, some people look at you like you're crazy if you just take a bite of it, but it's pure. I mean, this animal had one bad day. That's essentially what when we talk about proper hunting and done in the way it should be, we're talking about an animal who had one bad day. And when you harvest that animal and you're doing all these steps of honoring it, you know, there is something beautiful about having that connectivity to it and, you know, having, you know, slicing off a piece of it and just kind of eating it the way that not necessarily the way it should be eaten or how it was intended, because that's a completely different thing, but enjoying it, you know, enjoying what that flavor tastes like, you know. I think it's a great first step.
All right. So if folks want to follow along, where can they find you online?
So we're on Instagram, Gastronomy Live Events. If you just type in Gastronomy Live, it should pop up. We're also on Facebook, and you can also visit us on our website, gastronomycompany.com. We have a lot of great things that are happening in South Texas. We do a lot of cooking, not just cooking demonstrations, but what are called culinary activations, where we have hands-on sushi classes that we do for our clients. We work within local schools doing food history and food science exploration with the kids and of all grades. And we believe that teaching them where their food comes from is super important, and just having a really good time, man. You talk about dancing in your kitchen. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get them to enjoy the process of food. So whether it comes from a field or, you know, comes from a garden, whatever the case is, they just need to have a better understanding and they'll appreciate it more. So.
Awesome, man. Well, I'll make sure to link to all of that on the show notes page at thewildinitiative.com. Dude, so glad we got to set this up.
Yeah,
really stoked pleasure to have you on. This was a ton of fun.
Yeah, man. Congratulations on your success. You're coming up on number 200, right? I saw that.
Yeah, I still got to figure out what the heck I'm going to do with that.
Oh, but man, it's going to be fun. I know you're going to come up with something fun. But yeah, let us know if we can help you throw together some ideas. But yeah, man, congratulations. This is great what you've built. And yeah, I'm honored to be a part of it.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much.
Of course.
All right, y'all, that'll do it for this episode of The Wild Initiative. Make sure to check out the show notes page at thewildinitiative.com. Get links to everything we talked about in today's episode. Another big thank you to Josh for hopping on and sharing all that with us. Hope you were inspired to try out some new recipes, check out some new things. Get a little adventurous when you're out processing and cooking your wild game. Have fun. Give respect to the animal and make some amazing stinking meals. Well, y'all, that'll do it for this week. Looking forward to next time. But until then, I hope this episode inspired you to get involved, get outdoors, and plan your initiative for the wild.
Thank you for listening to The Wild Initiative. Please take a moment to leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher, and head on over to thewildinitiative.com to get show notes, check out the blog, gear discounts, other podcasts from the Wild Initiative family, and more.
You want to succeed. You want to fish. You want to be one of the greatest.
Tune in to West Marine's Life on the Water, presented by Costa Custom Boats, every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.
I'm Will Cooper, and you're listening to HuntStand's Make Your Mark podcast on the Waypoint Podcast Network. Stick around as I bring you more stories and interviews from veteran hunters and industry professionals who inspire us all to be better equipped in the woods and in life.